Are you a Catholic woman who loves your faith, but finds certain aspects of living it out challenging and confusing? Are you a Catholic wife striving for a healthy, holy marriage and sex life, but don't know where to turn for straightforward, faithful, nitty-gritty answers to some of your deep and delicate questions? Are you a Catholic mom who's tired of the compare and despair game we all fall victim to on social media, and are just in need of some solidarity as you discover your own unique motherhood? Are you tired of the sunshine and rainbows pitch? Want to lean into the both and of the mess that happens when the truths of our faith get lived in a fallen world? Well, if that's where you find yourself, you're in the right place. Hi, I'm Emily Frazee, your host of the Total Wine Podcast. I'm here to dig deep and tackle topics that we are all curious about, but maybe too afraid to ask. I'll answer it all with honesty and humor, because living the faithful life can make you either laugh or cry, and well, laughing burns more calories. Welcome to the show. Hello, and welcome back to another episode of the Total Wine Podcast. I am coming at you. This is it's kind of a Q&A episode, but kind of not. So there were not questions asked, but comments made for me to respond to. So sure, we'll call it a Q&A episode. But before I get started on the questions or the comments that I'm going to respond to, I have to tell you this story. A friend of mine this morning sent me this text that she just went to her annual physical at her OBGYN and mentioned that, you know, she and her husband are trying to get pregnant and, you know, they're having a little bit of trouble. And I cannot make this up, but her doctor started to tell her, now this friend of mine knows fertility awareness very well. Her doctor tried to tell her about the, and I quote, sperm meets egg method. I'm not making this up. It is a real thing. I am going to put the link to this in my show notes because it has a website. And it's the SMEP, Sperm Meets Egg Plan, is a try-to-conceive plan that helps you get pregnant faster with ovulation awareness and intercourse timing. Y'all, I'm not joking. Basically, on the 10th, this is what it says, on the 10th day of your cycle, you will begin daily testing with OPKs, ovulation prediction kits, immediately no. And upon receiving a positive OPK, you will try 3 more days in a row, skip one day, and give it one more try. Y'all, you cannot make this up. You cannot make this up. I just, like, God bless them for trying. But I just, you know, I'm putting this out here because I want every single woman who goes to her doctor's office who feels like she's about to be belittled for sharing with her doctor that she understands the inner workings of her body intimately through a scientific method of fertility awareness that she learned through a certified, trained instructor, to just remember this. That some doctors out there are telling people that to get pregnant, they need to use WANFOs. They need to use LH tests, which, by the way, if you're waiting on an LH test to target intercourse to conceive, you're too late. They're pitching this with a straight face. But we're crazy and we're stupid, right? Okay. All right. I just had to put that out there because, like, woof. Also, the title of this is just so unfortunate. The Sperm Meets Egg Plan. I just want to ask, like, whoever came up with the name of this, like, how do you think babies are made? Are they made like a different way other than the sperm meeting the egg? Like, who came up with this? I mean, even if you're talking about in vitro fertilization, like, an egg still has to get together with a sperm. Like, that's what's going on here. That's how babies are made. Anyway, okay. I just had to share this because just remember this. Seriously, next time you go to the doctor's office and they look at you like a dog in a new dish whenever you tell them that you use a scientifically researched and proven method of fertility awareness. Okay, so let's dive into the questions that I have. So the first one, and this one, I'll be totally honest. I picked it selfishly because this is actually a question that I have right now. That I and my husband are tossing around right now. And it is it okay as a Catholic to say, quote unquote, we're done having kids, And the questioner said they're doing NFP, so still open. Okay, so this, first and foremost, if all you're doing is tracking to be aware of your cycle and then either abstaining or not, like there's nothing wrong with that, right? If you are just, you are learning the way that your body works and then you're using that information together with your spouse to decide when you will or will not have sex, that's perfectly fine. Now, obviously, the deeper question is it okay to be like, we are never having another child? Let's break this question down. Let's kind of pick it apart. Let's look at this factually. If all you're doing is understanding your cycle and then abstaining when you don't want to get pregnant during your fertile window, by the way, your combined fertile window, I always like to throw that in there, the combined fertile window between a man and a woman, you're choosing to abstain during that fertile window in order to avoid pregnancy. This is not a disposition that is permanent, right? It's not like you're going on a birth control pill that like has ramifications that like if you go on it, you actually, there's going to be several months where you have like, you have to come off of it where the synthetic hormones get out of your system, right? Like this is, that's like a longer term, like a vasectomy or a tubal ligation or, you know, whatever other birth control, like chemical or surgical birth control method that you're looking at. Fertility awareness is not that. There's nothing permanent about it. The default of using fertility awareness is that discernment is something that is ongoing. It's something that you absolutely can revisit every single cycle if your situation changes, right? So this idea that like, is it okay to say that we're done having kids? Like, sure, because that only applies to this cycle, realistically speaking. It could change next cycle because you haven't done anything to alter your body. You're working with your body. So next cycle, you could be like, well, you know, like, hey, like we could, our situation seems a little different, or I feel the Lord calling us to something. Let's respond. So this idea that, first of all, that, you know, you have to, you make a decision at a point in time and then it has like permanent ramifications when you're using fertility awareness doesn't make any sense. It doesn't. You, all you're doing is you're making a decision for right now. And so that's really the disposition that you're taking on. It's not about, you know, making a decision that's like, okay, we need to think about the future in all of its detail because we don't know the future. All that we have, all that God has given us is right now. So I'm just going to use myself as an example. Because I can talk theoretical, but like, let's talk tangibles here. Okay. So my husband and I are in a situation right now where our youngest just turned one. Now my history is like, I mean, as you know, you know my story. I've had two surprise pregnancies. I've had secondary infertility, and then we conceived our third. It was a surprise in the sense that I thought I was infertile. So, I wasn't expecting to get pregnant. But pregnancy for me is not an easy thing. I'm pretty sure that I have like prenatal depression. Like I've never been diagnosed with it, but it's just, I am not the same person when I'm pregnant as when I'm not. I also deal with, low blood pressure. Like there's all sorts of things that go on for me physically, mentally, emotionally during pregnancy that I am like extremely limited in what I can do and what I can handle. So that's the reality. And when you're asking this question, you are looking at your reality. You are taking factual information, and that is becoming part of your decision-making process. The other factor for me is that, you know, all three of my births have been C-sections, and that if we were to have another child, like that child would be a C-section. Like I've just decided that for me, emotionally, mentally, physically, like I cannot, I'm very thankful that with my last pregnancy, I pursued a VBAC, but I cannot put myself and my family through that again. If we have another child, I will have a C-section. You can argue tooth and nail with me over that. I don't really care. It's what I've decided is best for us. Now, that all of that kind of together has a lot of ramifications. And one of the things that we've also dealt with our baby is that he hasn't really slept through the night consistently since he was born. So, I told my husband, I was like, basically, if we try to have another child, we have to be in a position where we can handle a crap 2 years. A full 2 years where, like, I am just running on empty. And the reality is that we have three children. We don't have the type of village that I need to be able to support myself. We don't have the financial ability for me to sustain the village that I would need if I were to have another child. But then, also with having another C-section, like there's the reality of like, I'm not getting any younger. The older I get, the harder it is going to be for my body to heal. And my babies are born via major surgery. So there's so many factors that go into this that it's like, you know what? It's really not a wise decision for us to have another child right now. It is not the generous, loving decision. Because we also have to look at our entire family situation. I have to look at my living children, right? I'm homeschooling my oldest daughter. I could not homeschool my daughter in the way that I want to if I was pregnant and dealing with, low blood pressure and potential depression. Our middle son, we are in the middle of trying to diagnose him with some, possibly some kind of neurodivergence. I don't talk about that a lot, and I don't really intend to, but that requires a lot of time and energy and intention. And then, of course, our one-year-old, like, he's not sleeping through the night. Okay, so just looking at the living children that we have, our financial situation, the human capabilities that both my husband and I have to support the actual living children that we have, it is not the loving, generous decision right now for us to have another child. And we're kind of in a position where, the problem of, I'm not getting any younger is certainly not going to change over time. But again, so right now, in our situation right now, we are trying to avoid pregnancy. It is not the loving, generous decision for us to add another child. And I don't really particularly foresee our situation changing. Now, that said, I can't see the future. I have no idea where we're going to be next year. Maybe our financial situation is totally different. Maybe our village situation is totally different. Maybe, I don't know. And so it's not my job to stand here and say, we will never have another child. That is preposterous. But it is not preposterous for me and my husband to say right now, it is not a wise decision for us to add another child. And our situation is not going to change in the next few months, likely. So this decision that we're making right now is likely to be, we'll likely ride this decision for like at least another year, I could easily imagine. But even as I definitively say that, I also know that God could absolutely come along and say, yeah, but Emily, you really need another child. You need another child. He's already done that to me three times. So I'm very open to the possibility that that even though the reality of my situation is such, and it's likely not going to change, God could still say, yeah, but there's something that I want to give you. There's something that I want to do in you, that I want to do for you, that can only happen if you have another child. So I accept both these things. And this is discernment. It's reason and faith. Reasonably, no, not a good idea for us to have another child. But I also accept that there is this reality where God could say, yeah, but you need another kid. So I'm open to both. I'm open to both. And the thing is that I think most people miss is that having another child is good. Having another child is good. The discernment is not a choice between something good and something bad. That's not discernment. That's avoiding the near occasion of sin, right? Discernment is choosing between two goods. And the two goods for us are to respond to our situation, which is that, yeah, it would not be a loving, generous decision for us to have a child right now. That is a good. And also, a child would be good. And so this is a difficult decision. because the more children I have, the more I realize just how beautiful and wonderful they are, and the more I want. Like, as crazy as that sounds, I would love to have another child. There is an ache in my heart for another child. At the same time, I recognize it's not a loving, generous decision right now. And it's difficult. It's not an easy place to be. So is it okay to say that you will never have another child? Sure, because you're only saying it for right now. And if you're only using NFP, there's nothing permanent about your decision. It can always change. The key here is, I just want to throw this in here too, is that this isn't something that you should be obsessing over, right? My husband and I are not obsessing over this. Like, we're looking at our situation realistically, practically. And I'm also open to the fact that, like, God could say, like, yeah, but here's another kid. But I'm not obsessing over, well, are we making the right decision? Because to me, the thing that I've learned is that the fruit of good discernment, the fruit of proper discernment, is interior peace. That doesn't mean that everything is going to go easily and everything's going to be wonderful and you're not going to feel any suffering or any pain. No. But in the midst of turmoil and chaos and pain, there will be this interior calm, this interior peace. And that's God-given, right? That interior peace is what gives you the strength to step into something that is very difficult, whether it is to have another child or to avoid pregnancy for a time. So yeah, you can absolutely say we're not having another kid, but because you're using NFP, it's not a permanent decision. So just keeping that in perspective. All right, so the next question that I want to get to, or the comment, that somebody asked me to comment on the priest on a pedestal mentality. And I'm just going to respond to what I think this is talking about and use it as a launch pad for what I actually want to talk about. Because this is my podcast. I do what I want. So priest on a pedestal, really, I think I know what this is talking about, that, like, you know, there's kind of this, and it's not a misplaced deference, but there is, like, this deference for priests as, like, these other beings, right? They're set apart, and so we kind of have to, like, you know, give them this deference and, like, bow. I'm making, like, that move, you know, where it's, like, you use both hands and you're, like, doing the bowing thing, right? Okay. I think that's what this is talking about. Now, on the one hand, yes, priests are set apart from us. They are consecrated. Their hands and are consecrated to, and their words are consecrated to be able to take bread and wine and turn it into the body and blood of Christ. Their words, when we go into the confessional, absolve us from our sins, right? These men are set apart, absolutely. And at the same time, they are still human beings. And one of the things that I think, you know, the priest on the pedestal mentality is a mentality that fuels abuse. It fuels abuse and it safeguards it. Because if these priests are, like, you know, up here on a pedestal, they can do no wrong. And because they're human beings, that will absolutely go to their heads. And because they're human beings and because they are in a position of shepherding, Satan will absolutely use that to inflict the most pain on his church. And that's what we're living in right now. So I'm fundamentally against the whole priest on a pedestal thing, because I know that Satan can use that, and he is using that for his purposes. So what's more important is, okay, Emily, well, what's the solution? Well, the solution is, and this is what I want to talk about, have your priest over for dinner. Okay, I know I'm harping on this all the time. But here's, so let's get into like, okay, what does this actually look like? All right, so first of all, why do I say have your priest over for dinner? Well, because everybody's got to eat. Food is a great equalizer. Everybody has to eat food. Everybody's got, three times a day, we all got to eat, okay? Now, where we get different is, like, everybody has different tastes and not everybody likes the same types of food and all that type of stuff. But I mean, you know, we're all Americans, okay? Let's gather around. Or if, you know, you have a priest who's from a foreign country, like, venture out a little bit, like, try something new, you know? I mean, it's great. And when I say have your priest over for dinner, this is really something that you can retrofit to fit your unique family. Now, the purpose of this goes back to a priest friend of mine shared with me. He said that the sacraments of holy orders, and matrimony are complementary sacraments of service. This really impressed something on me. And we cannot, basically, we need each other. We need the sacrificial witness of one another to bolster our own respective vocations. We married couples need to see the example of celibate priests living this sacrifice, living their fatherhood. And these celibate priests need to see married couples with or without children living the church's teaching. They need to see the things that they talk about from the pulpit on Sunday come to life. They need to see it put in practice. They need to be reminded, okay, the things that I say from the pulpit, here's what they look like in real life. We need this reciprocal witness. And a great, we're not going to get that in 1 hour on Sunday, or, you know, the 5 minutes that you're in the confessional, 15 if you've been real bad. You know, you've been out of there for like, you know, 60 years, whatever. Anyway, we need to create more opportunities where there is this interaction. And this is why I'm like, have your priest over for dinner. Now, again, it can look whatever way you want. You don't have to have your priest over for literal dinner. Maybe the best time of day for you is to have your priest over after Mass for brunch or lunch. Or maybe you're not a cook and you hate hosting. So maybe it's like, hey, Father, can we meet up at a restaurant? Or maybe you order in from Chick-fil-A. I don't know. I don't know anybody who's not a serial killer who ever heard this, you know, Chick-fil-A was on the menu and went, ew, gross. Okay. I mean, you can do whatever you want. It doesn't have to be this tricked out 7-course meal. I mean, if that's your thing, if you like to do 7-course meals, knock yourself out. But if you're a Chick-fil-A gal, go for it. It's not about like what you're eating. It's just the communal aspect here. It's the communal aspect. It's this opportunity to have a meeting of persons. I actually, to me, I want our priests around our home and around our children because I want my children to see these are human beings. I don't want my children to go around thinking that priests are just holier than thou because they're consecrated. Yes, they are consecrated and they are set apart, but again, they're human beings. And I want my children to have contact with the human side of our priests. The last two priests that we've had in our parish that we've had over, one of them, he's actually from, or his family is from France. So he and I like clicked right away because we're both super snobs about food. Like I'm Cajun French, he's French. So I loved cooking for him. He loved coming over. Like I loved creating, like I love cooking and I loved creating really nice meals. And, you know, we would really enjoy that around our dining room table. Our new priest who just came in, he's a football fan. He's like, you know, just way more casual, way more laid back. About that type of thing. And, you know, he's a different guy, but I'm learning kind of the human side of these priests, and we're able to accommodate, you know, these different aspects of, you know, their personality, right? They're different people. They have different personalities. And, it's fun to get to know them. It's fun to get to know them. I genuinely enjoy getting to know our priests, because the other thing here too, how many of us have been like, man, I really wish we had X, Y, and Z ministry at our parish? And how many of us think that the approach is to go up to our priest after Mass and bombard him and be like, Father, we really need X, Y, and Z. Why aren't you doing something? Listen, the man is swamped. Okay. He's one man with how many kids? How many parishioners do you have in your parish? That's how many kids he has. It's a lot of kids. Okay, and he's one guy. So if you see a need in your parish, don't go up to him and be like, Father, we need X, Y, and Z. Don't go full Karen mode on him after Mass. Have him over for dinner. Now, don't use that opportunity to accost him and to, you know, ambush him with your ideas. No, genuinely develop a relationship. Get to know the person. Because what's going to happen is you're going to learn, like, you're going to see, oh, wow, like there's so much stuff going on. We've invited our priest over and they show up late because right before they were supposed to come, they got a phone call because somebody was on their deathbed and they needed to go administer last rites. And you get to learn that like his time is not his own. And you actually find some beautiful points of connection. I've joked with our priest before, whenever they come over after that, I'm like, oh man, yep, you're a dad and you're getting a call from your kids at the worst possible time, you know, and they get calls in the middle of the night. And I'm just like, oh yeah, I relate. My kid hasn't slept for a year. I know how you feel, you know, and also just reminding them of their fatherhood, that this is, they are fathers. And when they get that call from somebody in the middle of the night to go administer last rites or whatever's going on, that's them being a dad. And so we're finding, it's just this beautiful way to meet their humanity. And it's just the most fun. I absolutely love it. And then within that context, if there is something that is, if there is a need that you see within the parish, you can present it in a way where you understand, like, Father, you know, here's something that I see a need for, and I am willing to help make it happen. And also, you've been to my home, and you've told me stories about how you're stretched here, there, and yonder. And I'm not going to present this in a way where I am going to be antagonistic towards you, but where I'm going to be understanding towards you. It creates a much more beautiful relationship. If you're wondering about, you know, okay, well, Emily, I've tried to invite my priest over and it's like not working, or he doesn't bite. This is not going to work in every single situation, right? This is so much, again, like, priest personalities are different. You may not jive with your priest. That's okay. What you could do, like, you know, if you haven't done this already, you could be like, hey, Father, I need a house blessing. That's a great in. I mean, he can't really say no to that. Use that to your advantage. But like, Father, could you come over and do a house blessing? And we would love to have you for a meal as well. And then see where it goes, you know, bait and switch, man. But for good purposes. And if that, you know, one of the other things that we've done is we've invited, when we had our priest over, we had another couple from the parish who was friends of ours. So there was also, there wasn't this pressure one-on-one. There was, okay, Father, come over, bless our house. We're going to be here, but also other parishioners are going to be here. And it was whatever was within our means, whatever felt comfortable. And, you know, the kids are running around and they're being crazy. And I'm like, yeah, you got to see this, man. This is NFP in action. Look at what it looks like. This is it. Actually, the person who asked this question, I know that she and her husband are dealing with infertility. And she recently had her priest over and she was like, I hope he sees the absence of children. And I hope that he understands, you know, I hope that he can see and appreciate what is going on in our life that is different, but also what is good. I'm like, heck yeah, girl, get after it. Get after it. I never followed up with her to see if that's how it went. But it's a beautiful place to kind of remember our humanity, but also, because priests need spaces where they can be human beings. I think this is one of the things that is just so impressed on me. Now, I've had very good experiences with having priests over to my home. I've had, you know, growing up, we had priests over. Even once I was a young adult in college, we had priests over. The priest who married my husband and I is one of those priests. My husband, actually, one of his childhood friends is now a priest, and we've had him stay. He's actually said Mass in our home, and it's just, you know, that is a whole other experience. So I've had very good experiences, and I know, and I just want to acknowledge this, not everybody has what I have. So again, it's also looking at your situation in prudence and discernment and saying, okay, what can we do? I was talking to another friend recently who was kind of running into the same conundrum. She's like, Emily, I just don't know what the inn is. And she lives on a, her husband's in the military. They live on a base. And I was like, throw a block party. You know, throw a block party. If you're trying to build community and you're trying to kind of invite your priest into that, just make it something casual. It doesn't have to be organized around something prayerful or scriptural or liturgical. Again, like, the more human, the better. It's a beautiful place to meet. And then within that meeting of human beings, that's where, you know, you can start to talk about faith and politics, and you can start to talk about more difficult things. That kind of segues into the third question or thing that I've been asked to comment on, which is basically how to find supportive family or couple friends and community in your parish. Now, I am very spoiled in the parish where I am, so I'm speaking from a place of privilege, which immediately undermines everything I'm about to say, right? Okay. I hate how we just go like full Marxist communist about this stuff. Like we just go full have and have nots. Oh, well, you're a have, so therefore your opinion doesn't matter. Okay. Anyway, drives me nuts. Just had to call that out for what it was. Community right now is so difficult. And I think one of the things, well, first of all, you know, we're still kind of unraveling all of the ittery, SH ittery, of the COVID pandemic, right? That did a number on us. I don't think we fully realize just the collective trauma that that whole situation unleashed. So I think to a certain degree, we're all kind of like, we don't know how to engage with people because everything is a touch point that can set somebody off in a heartbeat. Are you for or against vaccines? Are you for or against masking? Do you actually care about your fellow man, right? Everything is virtue signaling. So we're kind of coming off of this space where everybody was in that mode, right? And it's like, wait, how do we make friends again? How do we actually engage with people? And then you kind of factor in that everybody just kind of moved everything online and we're engaging more with people in a digital fake space. And now we don't even know how to do it in real life. There's a lot of rebuilding that we have to do and a lot of relearning that we have to do. But I really think, you know what, as I was thinking about this and just with people that I've talked to, and we got to go back. There used to be this thing once upon a time where in polite society and polite conversation, you didn't talk about religion and politics. And you know what? I think it's high time we went back to that. We go back to this time where in polite conversation, you do not talk about religion and politics. And let me explain why. It's not because these are things that we shouldn't talk about or because like, oh, Emily, you're being like a pansy. Like, what, are you afraid of the opinions that I have? No. Here's what it is. Think about your religious and your political beliefs. And just pause and just think about it for a second. What is your faith? What are your politics? Now, how did you arrive at those beliefs? Was it something, you know, that was just quick? No. Your religious beliefs and your political beliefs are shaped deeply and intimately by your entire life's experience. These are very personal things. They're very vulnerable things. They're very intimate things. And I think that it is just bizarre that we've gotten to this point where we lead with the most vulnerable, intimate side of ourselves with perfect strangers. And then we're surprised when we're met with complete vitriol. Nobody has a right to know your most vulnerable, intimate beliefs until they get to know you. Get to know a person. Don't just get to know what somebody believes and write them off one way or the other. No. Get to know the person. Get to know the context within which those beliefs exist. It doesn't, and it's not for the purpose of changing your mind or being like, oh yeah, no, I have had the wrong political or religious beliefs, but it's about remembering that, no, at the end of the day, I still have to love the person. And when you get to know someone's story, it's disarming, right? You can't argue with somebody's story. You can't argue with somebody's experience. You can argue with religious and political ideas. Sure, yeah, we can argue with ideas. We can't argue with experiences. And it is our experiences that have shaped what we believe. And so let's go back to that time where we didn't talk about religion and politics because these are the most intimate, some of the most intimate parts of who we are. They reflect our entire life story. And we shouldn't lead with that. That's like, it's like basically emotional dumping. Like, why is this suddenly like, this is polite conversation that it's like, oh, well, what church do you go to? What's your political party? Well, screw you. It's not the same as mine. What? Find out why. You know, my grandmother, one of her best friends was like this liberal woman from New York City. And my grandmother is, or was, like pro-life Republican from South Louisiana. And this was one of her best friends. Why can't we have that anymore? Because we don't get to know the person. We don't get to know the context within which a person's beliefs were shaped. Now, my grandmother did not agree politically, ideologically with this friend of hers, but she loved that person. She loved the person. And as a result, they were able to engage and have conversations about things that they didn't agree on and still have respect for one another. That's what we've lost. That's what we've lost. And it even comes out in these conversations about, you know, vaccinating or not vaccinating or masking and not masking. You know, if you mask, you don't care about humanity because you're a sheep. If you don't mask, you don't care about humanity because you're getting everybody sick. Same thing with vaccines, right? Why? Why is this why is it so black and white? Why can't we just approach people with curiosity? Why did you get the vaccine? Well, because I thought it was going to be the best thing for humanity. Okay. Well, maybe I'm sitting over here thinking you're stupid, but at the same time, I can at least respect the fact that, like, you were motivated for the common good. Okay. I can work with that. You know? Why can't we just approach? So how to build community in an age where we are still dealing with this collective trauma, in an age where we don't, where we lead with religion and politics and we use it as a vetting tool, which is so bizarre, why don't we just take a step back and kind of in the same vein of having your priest over for dinner, why don't we just gather around the things that we do agree on? And I'm not saying that you have to make friends with every single person, but if you want a community where you do have intentional conversation about faith and politics, you gotta start way further back. You know, us Cajuns, we know how to do this. It's like, we do the interrogations, man, all right? It's the who's your mama, who's your daddy, are you Catholic, can you make a roux? We are skilled in this art. We figure out how are we connected, what do we have in common, even at its most basic level. We're going to find something real stupid, like I don't care how small I have to go. We're going to find something that we have in common, and then we will build from there. And listen, human beings have way more in common than we don't. We really do. There is far more that unites us than there is that separates us. And we are so hyper-fixated on what separates us. And then we are like, why don't we have nice things? Why don't we have nice communities? Well, because we're focusing on what separates. We're not focusing on what connects. And it's not to say that we're going to agree with people. And it's not going to say that, you know, for some reason we're like, okay, if we're friends with somebody who disagrees with us, then we support what they believe. No! Listen, if I only surrounded myself with people that I agreed with, I'd have to divorce my husband. Like, where did we come up with this idea that we have to agree with everybody about everything? I find people that I disagree with but have kind of like a foundational respect for, those are the friendships I love. Those are the people I want to be around. Some of my best friends have been Protestants. We do not agree theologically, but I love talking with them because they challenge me in the best of ways. They challenge me by forcing me to question and to understand what is it that I do believe. And then they also, because they just rock it out the park with spontaneous prayer, it's like, okay, yeah, I also need to remember, they challenge me in that way that, yeah, my relationship with God does need to be personal. And I love that. I love that so much. Getting into conversations with people who don't agree with me, but with whom I share a mutual foundational respect. Those are the best friendships. And they didn't start by talking about politics. And they didn't start by talking about religion. They started by talking about what do we have in common. And it was really fun to discover what we did have in common. Some of the stuff was like, really? Okay. I didn't see that at all. And so there was like this element of surprise. I love surprises. So that was absolutely delightful for me. Open yourself up to be surprised, to be delighted. My grandmother, this same grandmother, she told me one time, she says, you know, Emily, and I've never forgotten this. You know, Emily, I find people so interesting. And I just want to live my life that way. I find people so interesting. First of all, it's so humble. You know, she's not puffed up about herself. She's genuinely interested in getting to know another person and getting to know their story. The only person that she couldn't stand, and I'm with her on this, was a self-absorbed asshole. Like, if you were self-absorbed, she didn't like you. And I don't like those people. That's literally the only type of person I don't like, is somebody who just thinks that theirs don't stink. Like, yeah, you're, no. But I find people so interesting. I just think that that's such a much better way to live. To just get to know people. One time I had this, I'll just, you know, this isn't about building community, but I just, there's something, now again, okay, I'm saying all of this as a raging sanguine cleric. If you don't know what a sanguine cleric is, go look up the four temperaments, all right? I am like people oriented. I love talking to people. Talking to people lights me up. Getting to know people lights me up. But I had this experience where I was flying down to New Orleans to meet my business partner, Mary, and I flew next to this guy. His name was Steven, and big old black guy, all right? And I sit down, and I have a book, and I start reading, and he turns to me, and he says, where are you from? And immediately, I closed my book, and I said, yes, we are going to have a conversation. Let's go. We talked the entire flight. It was fantastic. You should ask Mary. When I got off that flight, it was like I was high. I was just on a high. It was absolutely delightful. And what I discovered was, like, this guy and I have nothing in common. We both had kids. And that was about it. But we were able to share and have this conversation with one another where, by the end of it, we were both building each other up. We were both rooting for each other. There was nothing we had in common, and we just both engaged one another with curiosity. At one point, this was about an hour and a half in, so the first hour we literally just talked about booze because he had a huge gash over his forehead, and I was like, where'd you get that? And he's like, Vegas. I was like, alrighty then. And so that launched this whole hour conversation about booze. And then the last hour, we ended up talking about ourselves. We talked about our lives. We were asking questions, and I know so much about Steven. I still think about him all the time, and I still pray for him because he has a beautiful dream, and I want this dream to be fulfilled. He had a rough childhood. His parents died. He was raised by his older brother. There's a lot of, like, family trauma, and he was saying that, you know, at 16, he was shot 6 times, and he was talking about his experience of, you know, just the anger that came from the grief of his childhood. But he recognized that. It was so beautiful. And he said, you know, when my son was born, when I was 25, he changed my life. There's nothing this guy and I had in common. You know, he's got like a baby mama. He's got a 5-year-old. He's lost his parents. He's been shot 6 times. Nothing in common. And I knew so much about him, but he said he was a mechanic. He took so much pride in his shop. And he brought his son to work. He was like, I want to give this to my son. I want to give my son a better life. And at one point he said, you know, Emily, my big dream is I want to start a home for troubled youth. I want to start a home for boys like me. And I told him, I said, Steven, I was like, you are the perfect person to do that because you've been there and you can reach those boys in a way that nobody else can. You've been there and you've come out of it and you recognize what's going on. You're able to identify it. I don't know where Steven is now. I don't know what he's doing now, but I hope, I pray that that dream comes true one day. And it was so sweet the way he was talking about it. You know, he was like, I just don't know when it's the right time to do it. And I got to tell him, I was like, Steven, it's going to be when you feel that peace about it. Now, at one point, he asked me what the heck I'm doing, and I was like, well, I'm kind of, he asked me if I was traveling for business or pleasure, and I was like, kind of both. And he was like, oh, well, what's your business? And I'm like, okay. And I said, it's not really easy to explain, meaning I don't really want to tell you that, you know, I do fertility awareness stuff, but I did. I told him, I said, I do fertility awareness. And that's part of my business, and I help women understand their bodies and be able to learn about their health and avoid achieved pregnancy. And I was like really meek telling him this. And he just had the most beautiful response. He said, you know, I don't understand exactly what you're talking about. It sounds a little weird. And I was like, yep, totally honest. I love it. He's like, but what I hear is that you are trying to help people. And I think that's awesome. And you know what? Just be more like Stevan. Just be more like Stevan. I don't understand what you're talking about, but I can see the root desire in what you do. And I can resonate with that. If you want to build community, and if you want to connect with people, be more like Stevan. I still think about that guy all the time. Like I said, I still pray for him. I want him to make this home happen. But that was just such a beautiful interaction, just such a beautiful reminder that there is so much more that connects us than separates us. And if we can take that into every interaction, if we can kind of retrain our brains, I know, again, this collective trauma that we've got, we're very timid when we go into interactions with other people because we don't know when we're going to shoot off somebody, when we're going to hit one of their trigger points and, you know, get in an altercation that we didn't want. But if we start to just kind of go in like, okay, we are both human beings. Let's start there. How can we build community this way? If we just start to be the change we want to see, that's when we can start to build community. We can't build community if we are antagonistic with one another. We have to start with what we have in common. Maybe it's not the precise way that we practice our faith. Maybe our big goal is we want to have a whole bunch of girlfriends over to have a Bible study. But don't start there. Be like, hey, let's go to a brewery. My gosh, they're everywhere now. Or let's go grab a glass of wine, or let's go grab some coffee. Let's go meet and let's go get to know each other on a more basic level. And then maybe I'll get to know that, like, you've been through Bible studies and they were awful and you have no interest in starting one, but you are a wonderful person and I want to have you in my life as a friend. And maybe I wouldn't have gotten to that point if I started with a Bible study. It doesn't always have to be oriented around faith or politics. And we can still get to the point where we cultivate rich community centered around our faith, preferably not our politics. Those are ever changing. But we can start with those things that we have in common and build from there. Thanks so much for listening to today's episode. I hope it brightened your day and that you laughed as much as you learned. If you're enjoying the show and want more people to learn about what I share here, please leave a review and even share with a friend. I hope you'll join me again soon. Until then.